Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Each episode is a conversation with inspiring people who make wonderful contributions to our knowledge in these areas and spark curiosity and ideas to pursue. Join me, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
As a creative leader, then we need to be able to create the space and environment for people to be able to put ideas forward and to be able to hear those ideas, to be able to know what to do with them, to look at how they are in the context of the business that you have. How do you take those ideas and work them, or maybe they're not appropriate right now. However, they might be down the track. How do you store ideas? How do you let people know that their ideas are valued? But right now, you know, that idea can't get up and running for various sorts of reasons. So you, again, as a leader, you need to be able to have a very good understanding of your of the purpose of your organization, where it's going, and how these ideas fit or don't fit at this point in time, but also to encourage people to continue to be able to bring their most creative selves to the work that they do, and that you really value that.
Hi there, innovator. It's great to be back with another episode. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. I trust too that you enjoyed my recent conversations with Rob Rawson, the CEO and co-founder of Time Doctor, and with Mark Halpert, LinkedIn branding expert. I'm really excited today to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest, Dr. Catherine Lloyd. She's the founder and director of Maverick Minds. Catherine is a facilitator, an educator, a researcher, an arts practitioner, and a creative development coach. She is, in fact, Australia's first certified creativity coach with the Creativity Coaching Association, and she provides effective learning experiences for a wide variety of clients. A quick promotional message from our sponsor, that's InnovaBiz, where we help coaches and consultants build professional credibility, engage their target audience, and connect with their ideal client. That requires absolute clarity about who your ideal clients are and how you can help them. To help you get that clarity about your ideal client, take a look at our Marketing Master Mini Class, where in less than 30 minutes, you'll gain absolute clarity on your ideal client and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. Access the Marketing Master Mini Class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free and accessible without even giving away your email. In our discussion today, Catherine talked to me about the intersection between the arts and business and what one can learn from the other and vice versa. She explained the best ways to harness creativity and, in particular, building creative leadership in organizations and in communities. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Catherine Lloyd. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Brisbane in Australia, Dr. Catherine Lloyd, who's the founder and director of Maverick Minds. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Catherine. It's a real privilege to have you as my guest.
Thank you for the invitation, Jürgen. It's lovely to be here.
Bob Dick, who was our guest on episode 236 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, suggested that we have a conversation with you, so a big shout out to Bob.
Hello, Bob. Thank you.
Now, Catherine, you're a facilitator, an educator, a researcher, an arts practitioner, and a creative development coach. You're Australia's first certified creativity coach, which is fascinating that such a thing exists. I didn't know that. Mm. And your company, Maverick Minds, specializes in creative learning experiences designed to help shift thinking, give people new perspectives, and create positive change in the world, and particularly develop more creativity in leaders. So I'm really looking forward to delving into all of those things today and unpacking some of that. But before we start talking about creativity and creative leadership and change, give us a bit of a high-level snapshot of your background and how did you get to where you are today and what were some of the key moments in that journey?
They're interesting questions, aren't they, in terms of how a career develops. And I wish I could say, in some ways, I wish I could say it was a very, I knew exactly, you know, that I was going to go down this pathway. And, yes, I could see every little stepping stone along the way, but it's definitely not like that. And I think in terms of, like, work around facilitation, I'm not sure that anybody necessarily has that as a career destination or that in mind. But maybe that's changing, interestingly enough. I wonder now that possibly that could be changing because we're moving into a world of more conversation around facilitation and the notion of facilitation and what that can do in terms of leadership and working with groups and things like that. So I think potentially facilitation is becoming a pathway in terms of what people will do with their professional life. And so for me, my background is in the arts and I've always been in the arts for, you know, a very long time, did art at school and then went to art college and worked for a period of time as a designer in a couple of organisations. But very quickly, in my very early 20s, I started my own business. So I think I had a fairly entrepreneurial spirit at a very young age. And I think when you work in the arts and creatively, you need to have that entrepreneurial spirit because jobs don't really exist in some respects and in that regard. And again, I think that's changing in terms of the nature of how design is changing and digital technology is changing things. But certainly, you know, at the beginning of my career, that digital world didn't exist in the same way that it does now. And so the arts, I think, was a different field. So I trained as a graphic designer originally, but I realised I really didn't want to be a graphic designer. I actually was interested more in art, visual art, and so explored that, and that took me on a pathway, you know, in all sorts of ways of a combination of art and design and education as well. So I developed programs for visual artists and craft practitioners in terms of business development because I've always had an interest in business as well as the arts. And I think that people forget that the arts actually have a very strong business side to them. And we often think of the arts as being a bit fluffy and woolly and it's just creative and it's fun and it's play and it's all of those sorts of things, which it is and needs to be. But there's a very strong business focus to the arts as well. And if you want to earn a living out of the arts, then you also need to have a strong business mindset and entrepreneurial spirit to do that, whether you're a solo practitioner or you're a company, an arts organisation that exists and developing that organisation and developing a product for an audience. That all requires business nous and an entrepreneurial endeavour.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, looking back in probably my last 20 or so years, showing my age a little bit, but what's happened in the arts sphere in Australia I think is reflective of that recognition that there's a lot more business involved in arts and presenting arts, like understanding, you know, the audience and the different audiences and what they like and what their expectations are, and also in managing the way that various programs are funded and how they train new blood for the artists as well. So there's a lot of that there, isn't there? And I think what you said, I had to laugh a little bit when you said that, you know, everybody thinks of art as playful and that, but there's a lot of business like that. And I thought you could turn that round on its head and say everybody thinks of business as really serious, but there is a bit of playfulness to it, isn't there? So yeah. Both areas can learn from one another.
Well, indeed, and that's a beautiful question, you know, back to or response back to how did I get into the work that I do now? And I think that was the question that I had. So I left Australia and moved overseas for a few years. And in that shift, and I was ready to make a change in my career, and I really wasn't sure what that was, but I knew I wanted to work creatively. And fortunately, I took on a role when I moved to the UK, and I was based in London, and I ended up at the University of Arts London at Central St Martin's College of Art and Design. And I took on a role as their professional training manager. And that role was to develop training programs and workshops for corporate clients who were interested in art and design and how we could offer our services to a wider audience. And that was fascinating because it was how do we take these creative products and then turn that into something that organisations, businesses would be interested in learning from and knowing about. So some of it was quite technical, but one of the things that we started to develop were things around creative thinking and communication and other sorts of business associated ideas, but linked to the creative world of all of these areas of design, photography, jewelry, fashion. So those worlds have their own way of looking at things, and business can learn a lot from all of those fields and how they go about doing their business and what's the creativity that sits behind that. And that was fascinating to me. And so when I returned to Australia, I knew that I wanted to stay working in this connection between the creative world and arts and business, and what was that? And I wasn't really 100. I knew I had some ideas, but those jobs don't really exist, and they certainly didn't exist yeah. in Australia when I came back. So it was really having to kind of dig deep and think about what that really meant and to start to do some more research, and which is what I did, and an investigation. And, of course, I had made a lot of contacts in the UK, which was great because then I had people to go back to and refer to and talk to, and there was some foundation there, but I needed to explore that further. And one of the ways that I actually did that was to go and undertake my doctoral research at QUT and look at how the arts can be used in the context of individual and organisational learning and development, and drawing on the arts as a way of engaging people in organisational life in different sorts of ways.
Mm. Yeah, it's fascinating. I guess I'm fascinated in particular at the photography part of it. I mean, I was going to ask the question, how did you then bring those artistic endeavours in, and how did you help people take lessons away from that in a non-artistic environment, if you like? And the one that particularly interests me is the photography one, because that's one of my hobbies, always has been. So, yeah, so I guess that's the question. How did you kind of bring the lessons from the creative endeavors into a corporate environment where it was perhaps a fairly serious business environment?
Well, one of the clients that we had was the BBC. And so the BBC would come and work with our photographers to help them to think about their photography in different sorts of ways and to get a shift in their thinking around how they did their photography, what was some innovation around photography, what were different ways that they could approach, you know, doing their photography. So that's just one example in that regard. So there was the creative side of it. But, of course, there were people who came then to also learn about, well, how do you create a business around doing photography as well? So it was a bit of both, where we had, you know, people wanting to create businesses out of photography, but also businesses who needed to think more creatively about how they did what they did. And so, for instance, we had Sony come to us when they were working on a video game, very early video game, and we worked with the drama school to help them to develop characters and voices and things like that, and stories so that they could think about their gaming from a more humanistic perspective, because some of the way that they were approaching it was actually, it was very technical and it was quite one-dimensional in a way. So they needed to bring that alive with a much more humanistic way of being. And so it was getting people moving and playing and being in character and things like that to actually understand how do people respond in these situations, what do people do, rather than it just being a purely intellectual thing. It actually became an embodied experience of that.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me a lot of the, in the marketing sense where we've got so much automation and artificial intelligence now available to us through the technology that enables some wonderful things to be done in marketing and even in sales. But people are, there's a big risk that people abdicate to the technology and forget about the human interaction part. So I think that's a really good parallel of that where people thought, oh, we can build this game and it's all about the intellectual part of it and the technological challenges to build the game, and they forget about what the human experience is that the player wants to experience.
Absolutely, and that's why I think what I've seen develop over the last few years. So when I started my research and was looking at people thought I was speaking a foreign language, particularly here in Australia. There were things, of course, happening overseas, but here was a little bit sort of behind in that regard. And so people couldn't wrap their head around, how could the arts possibly influence or be of use to business world or business life? And so my research was, and there wasn't a lot around in the literature even, because professional practitioners don't really or weren't writing about their practice then. They were just doing stuff. And so, I was talking to the people that I knew, overseas and gathering their stories and what they did and what was their practice. And slowly I started to see practitioners write about their practice and to kind of show what they were doing in a different sort of way and to be more probably intentional and deliberate in some respects about what they were doing and really starting to kind of, I think, theorise around it and intellectualise around it, but also to still have that practical way of approaching things, which is still really important to the work, is to, at the end of the day, it needs to be practical. How do you apply this, on a day-to-day basis? And I think that's the important element here, is always bringing it back to how can this be applied and what's the value here too in that regard.
I want to talk a little bit about creative leadership and what you understand by that. But before we do that, let me ask you about facilitation, because you mentioned that facilitation, now it's starting to be a little bit more recognized as a kind of a mainstream profession, if you like. How is facilitation different than, say, a consultant that, we might have referred to in the past, or a trainer that, perhaps in the past people in business would be really familiar with their roles in a typical business environment?
Yeah, there is a distinction, and I think facilitation is quite broad, and it is very much about working with others and to create a space for people to come together and to, I think, design processes and potentially ways of being that enable the group to do what it is that they need to do. So the processes will be different depending on who the group is and what is it that they're endeavouring to do. It's not a one-size-fits-all or, this kind of tick-in-the-box way of doing things. It's a very dynamic way of working. I think that's what I would really think is at the heart of facilitation, is recognising how dynamic it really is and emergent as well. It's a very emergent sort of practice in that regard. So to me, facilitation is that you go in with a sense of inquiry and curiosity to endeavour to understand what it is that people are trying to do, and together, as a facilitator, you come in with some processes and ways of working and some methodologies that could be useful for the group, but you also need to be able to let go of those as things emerge from the group. So really it's about helping them to get to the heart of what it is that they're needing and wanting to do. And it may well be that the process that you came in with isn't necessarily appropriate anymore, and so you need to be able to work in a way that is responsive to their needs. So it's different to training, which is that, you know, there's probably a very particular outcome that needs to happen, or somebody needs to be able to use something, do something, and you need to know that they have the skills and capability to actually do that, and you're training them to do something. So by the end of it, you know, people know that they're capable of doing that particular sort of thing. So I would never think that you train anybody to do leadership. You know, that is a dynamic and evolving way of being, whereas if you need to learn how to do, you know, piece of technology or, you know, drive a truck or, you know, whatever it is, those sorts of things, that there are certain skills that you need in order to be able to do that particular task, I think it is. That's where training comes in. And there's learning attached to that, but it's also learning is attached to facilitation, but it's very different. And it's also, I think it's an individual engagement as well as a collective engagement in that regard.
Yeah. Well, that's a really good explanation. And I guess in some ways, perhaps the training part, where it's very structured training with a black and white outcome, if you like, you know, there's three outcomes, and if the tick boxes are checked, then it's worked. If not, then it hasn't delivered the outcome. And to me, that's a little bit, I guess, a lot more transactional than the facilitation approach, which is almost like enabling an experience where people challenge themselves and kind of teach themselves what it is they need to know, and by actually practicing it and being what it is.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a lot of reflection that goes with that. So I think of that the facilitation space also needs to be a reflective space, so that you're in action, doing things, having experiences that are associated with or are going to enable people to inquire into what it is that they're wanting to explore or change or develop or make a decision around, or whatever it is that you're coming together for that particular purpose of facilitation. However, in that evolving space or that emergent space, different things will occur as a result of that, and something else may become much more important, you know, than what people originally thought.
Yeah, or they might discover something that wasn't there in the curriculum, or, you know, they weren't aware of, or even the trainer or the facilitator wasn't aware of.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've got involved with many workshops and programs where we start with something and then we end up, you know, in another place, and along the way we're touching back into, but it's certainly a you can go off on some tangents because that's potentially the right thing to be doing, or is the right thing to be doing at that particular point in time, because that conversation becomes more important than a previous conversation or what was thought was needed. Actually, people recognize we need to be focusing in another way right now. So I think you've got to have plans and structures and, you know, processes in place, and you also need to be able to work with what is actually happening in real time as well.
So how do you keep yourself from just disappearing off on a tangent so that you actually come back to address the core issues or the core outcomes that everybody is targeting?
Well, I think it's actually understanding what the purpose is of why you're getting together anyway. So that's the initial thing. So why are we coming together? What is it that you want to do, and getting an understanding of that. So, you know, whoever I'm speaking with, you know, we'll nut that out, and hopefully I can work, you know, with others who are going to be included, because the more that I can engage others in the process, that's a really good thing too. So that when people arrive, they know what they're arriving to, and they're informed, and they want to be there. And I'll use one of Bob Dick's lovely expressions about that: they're willing participants. And that's what we all want. You know, we want people to be there because they want to be there, and they see the value in being there, and that this is a positive thing. You know, this is not, oh, here we go. It's like, okay, here we go. You know, here's an opportunity to think about things in different ways, or this is going to help us do something differently to how we're currently doing it. Think about it another way, make a different type of choice or decision. So you have that, and then the process begins. And if we go off on tangent, or if we find ourselves going down a pathway, then it's a matter of checking in, isn't it, to see, are we going off track? And is this important? Is this an important track to go down right now? Or do we park this for the moment and recognize that it's come up, but right now it's a distraction and we need to come back to what was originally decided? Or we're saying what was originally decided is not as important as what has emerged right now, and we need to really attend to this right now. So you have to have that conversation with the group, because at the end of the day, it's really up to the group to decide. And if I'm coaching an individual, it's really up to the individual to decide, you know, what pathway we're on. It's not for me to tell them which pathway they should be on. They have to make that choice. And so we go down these roads, and then it's like, do you want to come back? You know, you've gone off, you said you were wanting to do this, let's just check in about that. Okay, fine, carry on. Or no, let's go back and regroup and get back on with what it is that, you know, was the original focus for why we came together.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more then about creative leadership. It's sort of, you know, in a way the company name Maverick Minds suggests that it's a bit out of the box, so playing against the rules, it suggests to me. So is that part of creative leadership, or what does it encompass?
Well, creativity is at the heart of everything. I fundamentally believe that, and as human beings, we have innate creativity, and each of us has a unique way of seeing the world, expressing ourselves, being in the world, making sense of the world. And we bring that to our work, we bring that to our relationships, we bring that to our community, we bring it to everything that we do. And so to me, it's about harnessing that creativity and recognizing what it is and valuing it. And as a leader in an organization, or a leader in a community, or a leader in a group, it's really about appreciating that of yourself and valuing that and honoring that and knowing that, and then recognizing that of others. And therefore, how do you help to facilitate the creativity of the people that are around you and help them to bring what it is that they have to offer? Because everybody will bring a unique view or perspective, and that is incredibly valuable. Then what we do with all of that, that's the decisions that need to be made, and how you process all of that. But we're not robots. We are, you know, again, human beings with these creative minds that, given the opportunity, and we're problem solvers, you know, we're always doing, every day we wake up, you know, and, you know, yes, we might have some routines and certain things that we do, but, you know, we're making decisions all the time and kind of improvising, and, you know, we're improvising this conversation right now, you know, like, yes.
That's right.
Things like that, but there's no script here. And so that is, you know, we can imagine things. You know, that's one of the incredible capabilities that human beings have, is that we're able to imagine and see things, and with that we can bring things to fruition, and we can help others to do that too. So, you know, individually we can do that, but collectively, you know, we have enormous power. And so as a leader, recognizing that and harnessing that and working with people is really what is at the heart of, I think, creative leadership and really good leadership is about.
Hmm. Yeah, I think you made a really important point there, which is that, you know, we're all creative. I know that, you know, people I talk to, and I mean, this might be in relation to writing an article for a website or about their area of expertise, that they, you know, have the knowledge to write the article, or it might be drawing. I mean, I know I've said myself that I'm probably the worst drawer in the world. I struggle with doing stick men. So, you know, people put themselves down and equate that lack of skill in one particular area, perhaps, as I'm not creative. And yet, as you say, you know, we're all creative because we can have a conversation with people. We can come up with ideas. I mean, people come up with ideas all the time. Let's do this as a fun activity right now. That's a creative idea. And I know you talk about developing creative confidence. What sort of things do you do in the workplace or the business environment to help people kind of feel more confident in their own creativity?
It starts with a conversation, and it starts with putting creativity front and center, really. And so I talk about creativity quite a lot in the work that I do with people, and it's a word that, you know, I'll use and have it there so that people hear it for a start, and to be able to have the language around it as well, I think is really important. And then, of course, in the engagement with people, it's really about giving them the opportunity to show their creativity by some of the processes or ways that I work with people to let them see that for themselves and of others. And I get that response quite a lot from people to say, oh, I can't draw, you know, and immediately they think they're not creative because we have this notion that to be creative is to be able to draw or paint. And I guess probably to be able to do any of the arts aesthetic work really well, you know, be a musician, you know, all of those sorts of things. Mm. And yes, that is certainly creativity. But we also know that there's artwork that can become repetitive and maybe a little bit of like painting by numbers. And maybe it's not that creative anymore. And maybe it sells too. You know, there's a market there for it. And maybe it's creative for that person because that's what they're doing. So there's different types and ways of being creative in that regard. And I think what's important, though, is when you bring in some of the arts-based processes working with people, then you start to see how people can engage in different sorts of ways. And it becomes not just an intellectual exercise. Again, it becomes a more embodied and holistic way of working with others. And people get to see each other and their colleagues in different sorts of ways, and they get to see themselves in different sorts of ways. Because sometimes they'll say to their colleagues, you know, when they're doing something, they'll say, oh, wow, look at what you've done. Well, gee, I didn't know you could draw, or I didn't know you could sing, or, you know, it reveals things about people that in a workplace environment, often we only see the person as the role that they are at work, and we forget that people are much more than that. And often, so often when you sort of say, tell me about something creative that you do. Oh, I play the guitar, I'm a photographer, I go and do this and I go and do that. So people have got these creative things going on in the background, and yet often their first response might be that they're not creative because they're wrapped up in the role that they do in their workplace and forget about what potentially the influence of their creative work might bring to the work that they actually do. About it, you know, in a different way. You know, if you're a photographer and you're working in the workplace, how might you, if you start to think about, gee, how does my photography or my music on a day-to-day basis, how does that impact on my life. And if I was to bring more of that or aspects of that into the work that I do, how might my work change, or how might my engagement with the people around me change as a result of that too?
Yeah, that's right. I recall a few working sessions I had when I was still in the corporate world with team building exercises where there was a bit of creativity brought in kind of putting together games, if you like, that involve building things physical, something physical with models or so on. And exactly what you were saying before happened. All of a sudden you saw sides of people that you hadn't seen before, and it was exactly like that. Well, oh, Fred, we didn't know you were really good at building this thing or visualizing this 3D model that's enabled us to solve this puzzle, which, you know, some of us thought was really difficult. And all of a sudden Fred said, no, that's just like this. And there are a lot of examples of that really highlighted how, you know, using a game that was more artistic and engaged different thinking models, I guess, brought out people's skills, and people learnt about their colleagues and in team members in a much more broader way.
And a much richer way as well, you know. It's definitely, and we need to be, if we're creating learning experiences for people or opportunities for people to problem solve or to generate ideas and things like that, if you just stay purely in that intellectual way of being and words, I mean, we're very reliant on words, and that can get in the way sometimes. So sometimes actually using another creative method cuts through things in different sorts of ways. So I work with images a lot, and images are very, very powerful. You know, they tell stories really quickly, and people cut through and kind of reveal things or tell things in very different ways than if you ask them to talk about that from just a purely, I guess, intellectual or word-driven, you know, way. So the stimulus that it gives, and also then it links to often sort of storytelling and what have you. And so, you know, it creates a much more holistic way of working, and it's much more fun and interesting. I mean, it can be confronting for people sometimes, you know. I'm aware of that, because when you ask people to draw, and, you know, when I do some of my design thinking work, you know, I say to people, you're not going to be writing this down all the time. You're actually going to be drawing some of these, and people go, oh, no, you know, no. I can't.
Yeah.
But I say, I know everyone can draw stick figures and symbols and circles and squares and things like that. And it's really amazing, because then people start to actually, when they talk, so often what I observe is that people go back to that drawing and they talk about, and they're focused on the drawing while they're talking, but they are talking about the drawing and the image that's there. They haven't just put that aside. It's actually informing the conversation.
Yeah. We do this empathy mapping exercise, which to help our clients understand their ideal client, and we do that on a big whiteboard sheet of paper. And I tell people, you have to draw this, and of course, I demonstrate it first, so I show you how bad I draw. But the key thing is, you know, using drawings and symbols and visual representations of something that means something to you. And it's exactly as you were saying before. People, first of all, there's a lot of, oh, no, this is really bad, I can't draw. But then people will get up and describe their empathy map that they've put together, and it's quite amazing the story they'll tell from, you know, a little sketch or a little diagram or a symbol that they've drawn up, and it has so much more meaning.
Oh, totally, absolutely. Because if you wrote that out, you know, then it would be, you know, this very, very wordy, you know, document. And, you know, in some respects, that's why we should probably be thinking about, you know, the minutes or reports that we do from, you know, it needs to be a lot more visual, you know, rather than, you know, all of these words that in the end people are just kind of reading through, and pages and pages of the written word. And then, of course, you know, the written word can be problematic anyway, because do we think it means the same thing?
Mm, that's right. It's probably as open to interpretation as a sketch is by different people.
That's right. So we have this, we have a propensity towards words, but then, of course, how useful is that if, you know, and you know, for the people who speak English and it's their first language, then they have a, you know, they certainly have an advantage. Well, what about people whose language is their first language is something else? And so, you know, how do you create then, I think, to a certain degree, inclusivity? And I think by using different processes, methodologies, ways of working, I think it's much more inclusive in that regard, because in some way you will, you kind of will get everybody in some way or another, you know, and that's what you're hoping to do, is that something will resonate, or everything, enough will resonate for everybody at some point in time to be able to make a connection with what's actually going on. And it's part of their sense-making process, I think, in that regard too.
Yeah. Now, you said a few moments ago that you work a lot with images. I'm curious, how do you select images for a particular topic if you're working through a particular topic with a group and you want to use an image to work with that?
A few ways. I take a lot of photographs, and so whenever I photograph, I'm always often photographing with a visual image, as a visual image, to be able to kind of think about, I might be able to use this at some point in time in some way. So there's a bit of other thinking that goes on. So yes, I like that image, I like that what I'm seeing, but also potentially I can see how that could be used in another context to tell a story. So I use a lot of my own imagery, my own artwork as well. So I create and make art, and I try and use that as often as I can in sort of different contexts. And that's if I'm actually creating images too for people. However, I do get people to create their own images, and also to, you know, I've got a range of images that I've purchased from different, you know, organisations like Innovative Resources, you know, that kind of thing. And I use images like commercial images as well, that, you know, you can work with, that can be useful in terms of encouraging people to use an image as a way of introducing themselves, or it might be for idea generation, or it might be, you know, where are you currently at and where do you want to be? So, you know, a current self and a future self, or a current sort of situation and what would you like the future to be, and to be able to project and use an image to be able to, because there is that imagination as well. So we can actually see that. So there it is in our imagination, but there's an image that actually articulates that, and you can create a pathway to that in some respects too. You can create a story from here to there as well, and give the steps. So there's multiple ways of using images. I think they're very, very powerful, and I guess that's my bias in a way, to a certain degree, having a visual arts design background. I find the visual image very, very powerful working with people. So I'm mindful of that, because there's certainly lots of other ways to work with people.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I was fascinated how you do that, and I guess I take lots of photos as well, and sometimes I think of a story around the photo that could sort of find its way into a business sense, but then I've got so many photos that I can't keep track of where they all are and what might be useful.
You have to go through them. Spend a little bit of time going back over them and just looking at them, and even maybe creating a little folder with images that you kind of think could be useful in terms of some of the work that you do, you know, what speaks to you, you know, in that regard, about what's the message or the story that, you know, you're wanting to articulate.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm fascinated because I know you wrote co-authored a book, The Story Cookbook, and, you know, you've been talking about stories a bit, because one of the things I do is in one of my solo podcasts is tell a story about marketing, and I use my own photos in the blog post that go with that. So I'm fascinated about the transition from that visual image to story. So how do you go about integrating that with the story? Because that's a very powerful technique, I think.
Well, there's one example that I can use. So a colleague and I, Jeff Hill and I, had been working on this notion of provenance. And the idea of provenance is that it comes from the arts. It's a word that is used to be able to track where an artwork comes from and what's the provenance of that artwork. And provenance is really, really important in terms of the value of an artwork. So if you're claiming that you have a Picasso, then what's the provenance to say that that actually is a Picasso? They would want to be able to track that and know that. And then, yes, of course, the Picasso that you've got hanging on your wall actually is of that value. But if you can't, if for some reason you can't track the history of that artifact or that object, then there's question around, you know, who's the creator of that and where that actually comes from. So we took that terminology because it came sort of emerged out of my doctoral work as well, which is in terms of me investigating my practice, because my research was about using practice-led inquiry and understanding my own sort of practice, what brought me to where it is that I am now. And so there was kind of like a storytelling and narrative around that. And then we've kind of worked this idea of provenance, that every professional or every person has a provenance. We all have a provenance. We come from somewhere and we have a whole range of experiences and all of those sorts of things. So one of the things that I do with professionals that I work with is we work through a provenance process of looking back in time and understanding where a person's professional practice has actually emerged and come from, and to look at some of the key or critical incidents that have happened along the way. But I also encourage people to use images that might reflect that as well. So they're making, so the images become a bit of a catalyst to help stimulate thinking. And then their own reflection is part of that process. And they identify those things. And then in collaboration with another person, you know, another couple of people, in that sharing of, you then also go into a process of inquiry and reflection with one another and asking questions to help that person kind of unpack that even more about why, you know, out of pure curiosity, you know, how did that come to be and how did you do that? And it's a very empowering experience for people, and really people forget so much in a way. You know, the classic sort of Polanyi expression of we know more than we can tell. And so we forget all so many experiences. And then all of a sudden, I've had on a number of occasions people say to me, I'd completely forgotten about that. And as a critical incident for them, it became one of the most important elements that they realised had brought them to where they are now, and yet they had forgotten it or underplayed it. And it's only on reflection that they realise how profound that experience was for them in terms of, you know, where they are now. And the images can work as a really fabulous catalyst for helping people to kind of see that because of the stories that are presenting in images. And it's like, aha, that image kind of represents that in a way. And so you can sort of have the images as inspiration and then your own kind of story wrapped in and around that too.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I know that effect that you're talking about. I recently started going back to probably 30-year-old slides of mine to try to scan and digitize them, and I've got thousands of them, so it's a daunting task, but I kind of played around with some fairly old ones and as a result looked at some photos that I hadn't looked at for years and years, and then started thinking about things that I'd totally suppressed. You know, they were kind of totally out of my mind somewhere, and those memories all of a sudden started coming back. And, oh, I'd been to this place. I didn't even think that I'd been to this place, and so on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and not only that, but actually remembering experiences that happened during that time.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, I mean, Looney does a wonderful cartoon of, you know, that people are looking on TV at a sunset and the sunset's happening.
Yeah, yeah. Behind them in the window.
Sunset, you know. Why do we take photos? You know, we take photos because they do remind us of things and they help us remember something pretty quickly and really help an experience. Like smells can, you know, very evocative as well. Mm. So they generate memory very, very quickly. And I'd like to just, put a little kind of note too at the moment that right now in Australia we're suffering from these terrible bushfires at the moment. Mm. And, you know, so I feel for the people caught up in that and, of course, all the wildlife. And one of the things that you often hear people say is, I wish I'd grabbed my photos, you know, because they're such a powerful thing for people, is to be able to go back to that and look at that. And, yes, like, wow, gee, it's such a recall for us in that regard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's pretty awful what's happening right now in Australia, of course. And hopefully by the time this episode airs, that might be history. But, at the moment we're right in the thick of it. And as you say, you know, a lot of people obviously are devastated by the loss of their home and their possessions, but it's the photos that are probably the one thing, apart from their life, obviously, that can't be replaced.
That's right. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Very much so.
All right. Well, that's kind of a bit of a down note to end up on, but I think the photography thing is fascinating.
Well, I think actually in terms of the world of where we are now and in terms of creativity and innovation, I think that what we're currently experiencing is an opportunity there for innovation and creativity. Mm. And it needs all of us at the table to be part of that process. And this is what I think in organisational life as well, that we need everybody at the table. It's most important. And if people are being left behind or feel that somehow they're not included, or, you know, that, you know, when they put forward ideas, that those ideas are not listened to in some way or another, it's very frustrating for people. And, you know, it becomes disheartening for people. So as a creative leader, then we need to be able to create the space and environment for people to be able to put ideas forward and to be able to hear those ideas, to be able to know what to do with them, to look at how they are in the context of the business that you have. How do you take those ideas and work them, or maybe they're not appropriate right now. However, they might be down the track. How do you store ideas? How do you let people know that their ideas are valued? But right now, you know, that idea can't get up and running for various sorts of reasons. So, again, as a leader, you need to be able to have a very good understanding of the purpose of your organisation, where it's going, and how these ideas fit or don't fit at this point in time, but also to encourage people to continue to be able to bring their most creative selves to the work that they do, and that you really value that. That's really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you touched on the bushfires. I think given what's happening today in a whole range of areas, I'm certainly disappointed. I think, you know, if you take the general mood in the press that's representative of probably most people, I think there's a great deal of disappointment in our political leadership across the board, whether that's in world politics, whether that's in world economics, or whether that's in Australia with our bushfire crisis right now. But we all have a role to play, and we all can, you know, be more creative in how we approach leadership. And I think that's a really important message.
Yeah, definitely. And also too, you know, and if we just take away the idea of leadership, because of course, you know, there's a whole conversation around leadership, and it can seem, you know, a really big topic in that regard, and what does it really mean? And, you know, we've had all these ways of being a leader, and you know, and what, you know, who's a leader and who's not a leader. And we all have leadership capability at different points in time. And again, in organisational life, we create these odd structures and hierarchies that tell, you know, one person is a leader, you know, more than a leader than another person and things like that. But actually, when you look around in organisations, you soon get to know who is also that people listen to and are inspired by and things like that too. So I think the notion of leadership is, why would people want to be, or why would people follow you? You know, they might do so because, you know, that's what your role is, but actually do they really believe in you? And I think that's a big part of leadership, is to become very authentic in your own leadership. And when you tap into who you are and your creative being, you really start to get a sense of who that is and what that can look like and what that can be. And therefore, you know, how you can then work with others to enable them in that way. So we're all capable of leadership at different points in time, and we're all creative and can step into our creativity at different points in time in different sorts of ways, depending on the circumstances and the context we find ourselves in, the people that we're associated with, the environment, you know, how conducive it is to that. There's so many factors that can influence how our creativity manifests too.
Mm, yeah. Well, I could go on talking leadership and creativity for a long time, but I'm aware of the time. So I think it's a good point to move on to the buzz, which is our innovation round. And I've got five questions. Hopefully you'll give us some really snappy answers that'll inspire people to go and do something creative and leadership focused today with what you've given them.
Great.
Are you ready?
Yes. Hit me with it.
Yeah, what do you think is the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
I think there's a combination of things. There's a combination of the environment in which you work in. Like if you're talking about in an organisational context, then it's how has the organisational set itself up? And the rhetoric that's around innovation is really interesting. So, you know, really, do people want innovation because it means change, and do they really want that? So are you creating an environment for that to actually happen, and what pathways or what sorts of opportunities and ways do you enable people to be part of that innovation process? Because innovation comes from people. It comes from the creativity of people. So how do you create an environment for that to actually happen? And are you prepared to take some risks in there? Of course, there's a level of risk-taking. There's intentionality around that. You know, what are we wanting to be creative for, or innovate for? What's your level of blame or failure there? You know, if something doesn't happen, are you going to accuse people of, you know, that idea didn't work? You know, so we know, again, if people think they're going to get blamed for something if it doesn't work, are they really going to put their head above the parapet and get it sort of knocked off if something doesn't? So experimentation is a big part of that. And do you have a culture of experimentation as well, and allowing some improvisation to happen in your organization too? Structure, freedom, you know, it's a paradox really in some respects.
Yeah, so it's the strong point there is really around having a culture of innovation and the ability to experiment without fear of failure, in the sense that there's going to be repercussions or penalties, if you like, for failure.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Now, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I think I'm intuitive, and so I sort of rely on my intuition somewhat, and I'll see something or hear something and it sparks something in me, and so I'll look into it and I'll do a bit of research around it or start to think. And there's something in there that it's not like a massive aha moment all the time, but there's something that lands for me where I go, there's something here. And so I'll start to investigate it. And sometimes there can be a quick sort of turnaround on that as an idea, but sometimes it bubbles away for quite some time. And so, you know, I'll do bits and pieces. So I'll often let things lie as well. I'll write things down. I've got ideas books. I'll make notes. I'll keep a journal. And then I come back and look at it again. So I'll have works in progress to a certain degree where I'm kind of nurturing things at different points in time, and then all of a sudden, you know, something will present itself in a way that I'll think, this links with that and that goes with that, and this is the right time for this to actually happen. So I'm working on a little I'm working on a book at the moment. So you mentioned the Story Cookbook, which is a book that Andrew and I wrote about using stories. We're going to be putting together another one. That's something that we're going to be working on. However, I'm also working on a book of my own about creativity, and it's not a big, heavy academic book. It's a little practical book that I'm exploring, and that's been bubbling for a while, you know, and I've just been sort of doing little bits every now and again, and now, you know, the momentum is there, so I'm kind of more involved with it now at this point in time.
That's great. So, I mean, one of the key things there for me is you kind of keep track of ideas by writing them down, and you have a journal and you revisit things a lot. And I think, you know, for me, sometimes I look at old photos as well, and there's ideas there. So I'll start to take, I mean, that's easy to do now with phones. So you just take a picture of something that grabs your attention that might be an idea for something, and then I often come back to those and get some ideas out of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Now, do you have a favorite resource that you use most often?
In terms of working with others, with groups, images certainly, you know, like when I'm coaching, I work with images a lot too. There's models that I'll work with for scaffolding certain things at times, and there's some tried and tested models that are so useful, you know, some of the action learning principles, you know, things like the scarf model for, you know, about how we kind of respond to others and things like the ladder of inference. All of those sorts of things I think are incredibly, they're really good models. However, I call myself a bit of a bowerbird, really, and so I kind of draw on, or the other word that I've used a fair bit is a bricoleur. So I take what's available and kind of see what's useful, and I'll play with it. So to some people who might be purists around certain things, I may not be as pure as some people in terms of how they use things, and I'll take bits and pieces and reconstruct it and put it together in different sorts of ways that is useful to me. In how I work, and then often I'll present that to others as well, because if it's useful to me, I think it might be useful to others, but it certainly makes sense to me, and if it makes sense to me, then I can at least explain it to others, and hopefully, you know, it might be useful to them. But one of the processes that I've been working with is a personal one. You know, there's this renovator's delight. So there's a guy called Jason Clark who did a TED talk, and I kind of use his notion of the renovator's delight. So when you're renovating a house, what are the things you want to keep, chuck, add, and change? So I think that's a really nice little metaphor to work with. And the other one is the Kanbans as well. And I started working with that, and I find that really good. And I've got, you know, my flip charts up there with my sticky notes on, and I have found that quite a useful way of working. And I'm a bit of a sticky note person, so I have probably far too many sticky notes, actually.
Yeah.
But I like the way that I can move them around and take things off, and then that's done, and that goes into the column of that's done. I pull it off and I go, ta-da. And then, like, there's the column there with all these options and ideas, and what am I currently working on, who am I waiting on, you know, all of those sorts of things. So that's quite a nice – I like things that are visual in that regard.
Yeah, well, there's lots of interesting tools there. I'll have to check out that TED talk on the renovator's delight.
Right.
Sounds fascinating. Yeah, and Kanban is great, and I'm a big fan of sticky notes as well, so we've certainly got that in common. Now, what's the best way to keep a project or a client on track?
Well, if it's my own projects, then it's being accountable to myself. I do work with a marketing person at times, and I'm accountable to her, and that's partly why I've engaged her a little bit more, so that I can be a little bit more accountable, you know, in that regard. But it is really about being accountable. You know, it's my business, you know, so what I don't do, it doesn't get done, really. And so I have to, you know, be motivated and think that it's worth doing and stay with it. But I am a very motivated person in that regard, and when I get a focus around something, you know, that really helps. And if I believe in it, then, you know, it takes me through. If it's working with others, well, really, whose responsibility is it? You know, so if I'm working with a group, it's really ultimately their responsibility. So it comes down to commitments and how we all make commitments around things, and then who's responsible for that. So, you know, taking action, you know, with a group, you know, it's like that's your responsibility. You know, if you're going off to work together, that's your responsibility. If you're going back into the workplace after this. So I have to be I'm mindful of whose responsibility it is at the end of the day, and, you know, getting clear on that.
Okay.
And then, well, there's a lot accountable, you know, really, you know, who you work with.
Yeah, I think accountability is a big thing in that. And yeah, there's certainly a lot of value in that. Okay, now I think we've touched on this a little bit, but maybe you can kind of recap. What's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
Well, we're all different, you know. Yeah. First and foremost, we're all different. You know, we're all unique, and so I think the fact that we are unique, we're differentiated anyway. And then, because we're unique, we are going to see the world in different ways, and different things will resonate, and we'll have different perspectives and views. And I think the notion of curation is interesting here, because what attracts us, what we're drawn to, what we notice, what we read, the experiences that we have, all becomes, there's that provenance again to a certain degree, it all becomes a package of who we are. And so when we understand what that is and know that, we can curate that in a way that is useful to us and potentially useful to others as well. Mm. And may well resonate for others, because we offer a different perspective and view of the world, and we've curated in a way that's unique because we're unique.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I hadn't heard it expressed like that before, curating our own experiences in a way that's unique. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, it's quite powerful, because it's not about having to be like anybody else. And, you know, people will either resonate with you or they won't. But if you keep on trying to do things for other people, then you're forever, you know, trying to be what it is for others. But if you come back to finding your path and your way, and, of course, if you're working with clients, that, you know, of course you've got to sort of work with them. But at the end of the day, what we hope is that people are working with us because what we offer and what we do resonates for them, and it's partly about who we are as people.
Yeah. Yeah, which brings us back to the human connection.
Exactly.
All right, well, yeah, thank you, Catherine. This has been really great. Now, where can people find out more about you and the work you do, and learn about your books, and maybe even reach out and say thank you for what you've shared today?
They can find my website, Maverick Minds, which is www.maverickminds.com.au. I'm on LinkedIn, Dr. Catherine Lloyd at LinkedIn. I do have a Twitter handle, and that's at Catherine at Maverick_Minds. You can subscribe. People can subscribe to Maverick Minds newsletter. I don't bombard people. I send a newsletter out every now and again. And there's information on my website that might be useful to people to have a look at, and I endeavour to update that as much as possible. And certainly the newsletters is my big focus for this year, is to get a few more out, because I didn't get as many out as I probably wanted to last year. So this year I'll have a little bit more of a focus in communicating in that way.
Okay. So, and we'll have links to all of those in the show notes, so people can click straight through and find them, even if you're listening to this episode in the car.
Yeah, great.
All right. Now, what sort of final piece of advice would you like to leave the listener in terms of their leadership aspirations and innovation and creativity?
Fundamentally, I think we all need to be curious. I think curiosity is a big thing. And remaining curious, because the moment we've stopped being curious, is then we stop learning. We've already made a decision or a judgment around something, and so, you know, we potentially miss what's available to us in that regard. So I think curiosity as a leader is really, really important. And recognising that as a leader, you don't have to solve everything. It's not your responsibility to do that. That's where facilitation comes in. How do you facilitate others and the environment for people to be able to step up and make decisions and do things like that? Leadership is about vulnerability, some being humble as well, and recognising that good ideas can come from anywhere. And if you're curious and you're listening, you're going to hear some really wonderful ideas from people and, you know, and encourage them to take that idea and run with it or to explore it in a way that's really useful to them or to your business or to the group that they're working with in that regard. So, yeah, I think that's quite a – and listening. Listening is a big one.
Mm. Yeah, well, I think curiosity and listening kind of go together in my mind. But yeah, that's really great advice. And I was just reminded, we have a couple of cats that are our pets, and you know, they say curiosity killed the cat, and sort of anything unusual going on, they're always curious, and it always amazes me that, you know, we think, oh, isn't that cute? The cat's really curious, and we think, well, we shouldn't think that's sort of out of the norm. We should all be curious.
We should all be curious, you know, like in some respects we should all be in awe of what we have and what we are, because it's really quite remarkable if we actually step back from this. This is why also the other thing I would say as a leader, that reflection is a really important component. To be a reflective leader, spending time reflecting is so important. If we're caught up in this world of busyness and rushing from one thing to another all the time, it's not helpful for ourselves and it's not helpful for the people around us. So good leaders need some time out to reflect on what is it they do, why do they do it, understanding what drives them, what motivates them, you know, what inspires them. What is it Socrates, you know, said about a life unexamined? You know, to examine our lives is a very profound and powerful thing that we need to do for ourselves and to be the best that we can for ourselves and for the people around us, really.
Yeah, yeah, that's great advice. All right, well, finally then, Catherine, who would you like me to chat with on a future InnovaBuzz podcast and why?
Oh, there were a few people I had in mind. So this was very difficult. So I'm happy to give some other names at some point in time because I'd love you to have a chat with these other people too. But ultimately I came up with a fellow by the name of Andrew Barnes. Andrew is the founder of Perpetual Guardian, and it's a New Zealand-based business, and he had an epiphany of the four-day working week and decided that he was going to introduce that into his organisation. And he presented that idea to his staff, to the employees. He said he didn't know how they would do it, but he thought it was a good idea and wondered if they thought it was a good idea. And, of course, everybody did think it was a good idea, but how would it actually happen and what would they do? And it's a great story, and they have introduced it. They've done some marvellous research around it. They've had universities coming in and researching, and he's just released a book as well. He calls himself the architect of the four-day working week, and he has a book out. I think it's just been launched as well. And I have a conversation with Andrew because I think he's such an interesting fellow, and he has a military background, but he has an artistic family, and there's all this. I've spoken to him a few times and had some communication with him because I was fascinated with, because I'm a great believer that we need to have a four-day working week. Wonderful thing and a great idea, and he shows that businesses can function as a four and actually do more and be just as successful, just as productive, efficient, and probably even more so because of, you know, people are rested and they're working on some other things as well. So great story there.
Yeah, sounds fascinating. It's interesting because I came across something in my feed, but I haven't actually read it yet. I'll have to go back and find it again now. That was about a business that decided that Wednesdays would be a day off as well. so that essentially they went to a four-day working week, but I kind of parked it to read later. But I'll have to go back and find that one now because it sounds like it might be related.
So, yes, it's worth investigating. But Andrew, he's a great guy and definitely worth, he'd be a great interview for you.
All right. Well, thanks, Catherine. This has been absolutely fascinating and I've really enjoyed having a chat with you about all things creativity and exploring kind of how images and photography come into storytelling as well as on creative leadership and how we can all make some change in the world by being more creative leaders and being more curious. So thanks so much for sharing your time and insights with us today. I wish you all the best for the future and let's keep in touch.
Oh, Jürgen, thank you so much for the invitation and thanks to Bob for putting me forward. And I really value the opportunity and it's a wonderful opportunity to do a little bit of self-reflection in that regard. So you're providing a wonderful service.
Bye for now.
Thank you, Jürgen.
Hope you enjoyed that insightful and really informative conversation with Catherine and took something away from her episode. One of the highlights for me was how Catherine uses her own photographs to weave into stories that become metaphors for a particular lesson she shares with her audience. I'd love to know what you took away from Catherine's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Catherine Lloyd. That is CatherynLlOyd, all lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Catherine Lloyd. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Catherine there, as well as links to the Maverick Minds website, to her social media pages, and the other resources we spoke about in our conversation today. Catherine suggested that we have a conversation with Andrew Barnes of Perpetual Guardian and author of The 4-Day Workweek on a future InnovaBuzz podcast episode. So, Andrew, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast courtesy of Catherine Lloyd. Remember to check out our Marketing Master mini class at innovabiz.co/marketingmaster. It's completely free and accessible without even giving away your email. But most importantly, it will enable you in less than 30 minutes to gain absolute clarity about who your ideal client is and how you can communicate with them to build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship. And if you'd like our help to go even deeper into marketing mastery, or our help with producing your very own podcast, even launching your very own podcast if you don't yet have one, then send me an email to jürgen@innovabiz.co and we can set up a quick call to have a short conversation and find out whether we're a good fit for one another. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we have more fantastic guests lined up, including business strategist Ken Foster, author of The Courage to Change Everything, and Dr. Jeff Spencer of Corner Man Coaching. Stay connected with us by subscribing to the InnovaBuzz podcast at innovabuzz.com/subscribe. innovabuzz.com/subscribe. Make sure you never miss another episode. It would also mean a lot to me if you leave us a review because what you think matters. I'd love to hear your thoughts, your ideas, your suggestions, or questions you have, so go ahead and share them in the comments below the blog post for this episode. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.